From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Have you seen Saving Mr. Banks? It's one of the great movies about movies, in which Tom Hanks plays Walt Disney during the tumultuous production of Mary Poppins. Having grown up watching Uncle Walt on TV, I was struck by how well Tom Hanks perfected Walt Disney's particular speech pattern. Of course, I stayed for the credits and was not surprised to see that Tom Hanks' dialect coach was my old friend, Jessica Drake. Not surprised because I've followed Jessica Drake's career for years and she always does great work. I invited her here to talk to us about her craft. Jessica Drake, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with Saving Mr. Banks. How did you get involved in that particular film?
Actually, it's a funny thing. I was working on another film. I was in Canada working on The Life of Pi. And the DP on that mentioned this whole thing about Mr. Banks to me. And I actually hadn't been in touch with Tom Hanks in quite a while. And I sent him an email. And I said, I would love to do Walt Disney. I don't know if you have any idea about working with somebody on it or not, but that would be such a cool thing to do. And after about 6 weeks, I heard back from him, and he said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. And then we got very immersed in it, and it was wonderful. And, of course, we had terrific access. His daughter, Diane, who passed away recently, was still living, and she started this amazing museum, which I highly recommend to everybody, that's in the Presidio in San Francisco.
Yes, the Disney Family Museum. I love it.
Exactly, which is kind of, in some ways, like going to Disneyland for grown-ups. But she opened it up to us for a day. I think they're closed on Tuesdays, and that was the day she opened it up to us. So we had it all to ourselves, and there's an amazing amount of audio of Walt involved in all the various exhibits, and at the end of it, she also gave us CDs of those recordings that they were using. And that was a real trove of information, and fantastic in terms of matching his cadences. It's not just his accent. He had cadences that we're all so familiar with. And Tom is so meticulous in his process. He really worked to get all of those, and I think he did an amazing job. So that's kind of what the process was there.
It really is an amazing job, and the cadences are... there, like when he says Peter Pan.
Yes, exactly. Very good.
Yeah, thanks. And my ear was really picking up on it, thinking that's fantastic. So you sit down. Your job is to like listen to those tapes and really get that thing, and then sit down with him. And
yes.
What's that like? I mean, you've worked with a lot of people, Russell Crowe and Steve Martin and Rachel Griffiths, but Tom Hanks in particular, is he easy to work with?
Oh, yeah. He's amazing. He's wonderful, and he works very hard at it. You know, the process, it's an interesting thing. I have kind of almost like a subspecialty of what I call real people dialects now, because I've done so many of them. The first time I was asked to do it was many years ago on a film called What's Love Got to Do with It, and they needed someone to coach the actors to sound like Ike and Tina Turner.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was called on it, I thought, God, I don't know if I can do that. That's kind of weird. It's sort of a whole another level of having to sound like someone who is also incredibly well known to the public.
Can you do that? It's like doing impressions then.
Well, see, that's how I started to think about it. And I thought, well, now, what is that really my job? Or is it somebody like Rich Little,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
Should Frank Gorshin be here doing this? But the more I sort of thought about it, and I went into it very candidly saying to the director, I don't know if I can do this. You know, I don't know if this is really my thing. And he said, well, I don't know who to ask, and I have no idea how to approach it. And it seems to me like your qualifications would match this task. So I just went into it with an open mind about how to approach it, and what became very clear to me very quickly is if you went at it like a Rich Little or a Frank Gorshin, there is no room left for the actor in that. It becomes an impression.
Right.
And they can't interpret that role because they're too locked in and too worried about sounding like that person in every millisecond and every syllable that they utter. And it becomes too confining. And at that point, then you might as well have Rich Little do it, although he'd have been terrible at Tina Turner. So
Tina Turner has a famously odd accent.
She has an odd accent that morphed, that changed considerably over the course of her lifetime.
Yeah.
So that was another problem. We had to play her as the girl from Nutbush all the way through the Tina Turner we now know, who has a lot of these British cadences and has lived a lot in Germany and things like that. So it was very challenging, but I think the point I'm trying to make is that since then I've done many, many, many of these, lots of presidents, lots of them. I did a movie for Oliver Stone called W that was probably the most challenging because we had to do a sitting president. We had to do Bush while Bush was in office. And his father, and the rest of his family, and Dick Cheney, and all those guys.
So you had to listen to more Bush than you ever wanted to listen to.
Well, I'm sure this is not a political show, but I will just say that I felt like I was being burned twice by George Bush because I had to sit in a room and listen to this guy for 40 hours. So,
torture, how torturous that would be.
Torture, and I'm here to say that absolutely every stupid thing he says in that movie is dead real. I mean, we have recordings of him saying it. So all of that, you know, I wish I could remember some of them now. Misunderestimating me and things like that he says. You're misunderestimating me. It's real. He said all that.
Yeah.
But anyway, my point is just what I have kind of realized is that if you take the key moments, the things the public really knows, like in the case of Walt Disney, yeah, it's that Peter Pan speech that kind of opens the movie. Or for Tina Turner, it's her intro into Proud Mary that she talks into the song. Or if you're going to do Roosevelt, you've got to do, you know, and you're doing Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself. Or George Wallace, you know, Segregation Now, Segregation. All those famous things. And you really try to match those dead on, syllable for syllable. Then you can have a little more freedom in the scenes that are made up, that people don't know exactly how you sounded.
Well, of course, with politicians, you've got people who speak a certain way, and then when they give speeches, they have a different voice.
That's right. I did LBJ for something, and that was amazing because I did him in 2001, exactly, I think, that year. Those tapes, those famous White House tapes that he made were released because he had put a caveat on them saying that, you know, they could not be released until 50 years after his death, and bing, it came up right at that moment. That was amazing because the difference in his voice between his private voice and the voice we all knew is big.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to hear it, really hear it.
Yeah.
So, you know, every once in a while you get a gold mine like that. But that's what you try for, of course, with all these people, is can you find something where they're speaking candidly? And sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. I'm working on a project right now, which is a movie about Hank Williams, the country singer.
Sure.
And we just don't have anything of his that is not him on the radio being folksy, you know. That's harder. It's just harder because you don't really know what the real guy sounded like.
Use George Hamilton's voice.
I promise you this will leave George Hamilton in the dust.
Okay,
a vague memory.
I love that picture. What are you talking about? We're talking with Jessica Drake, and she is a great dialect coach. Did you say dialect coach or dialogue coach?
Dialect.
Okay.
Definitely dialect. Dialogue coaches, that has a long history in Hollywood that is confused, I will say, because I do think there were times when people were hired to do what I do and called that, but it's really now kind of a misnomer. Really, dialogue coaches are there to help people learn their lines, which is a whole different
thing. I see. Yeah. So you assume by the time you worked with Tom Hanks, he already knew all of his lines.
Yeah, he never needed me for that.
Do they come? do actors come to you with a particular phrase that they're having trouble with? I mean, I know you've worked with a lot of actors that are, say, Australian or British, and they need to speak American. Do they come to you with a particular phrase that they're having trouble with?
No, they come with the whole thing, the whole role usually, and, you know, we'll work through all of it. It's not going to be just for one phrase or even one speech or one scene. It's going to be the whole thing. And, you know, in the end, I'm just there as a guide. It's I can't get inside anybody and talk for them. That's the magic they bring to it, and they bring a lot of magic to it. And I've been really blessed to work with people like Tom Hanks because he's such a gifted actor. And the thing is, in the end, if all an actor is thinking about is their accent, it's not very good. So the actors who really, really pull it off are the ones who aren't thinking about it anymore. They're acting it. They're just being that person.
Oftentimes, I find dialects to be distracting in movies. And I don't think actors always need to use them. You know, like Clark Gable or Leslie Howard in Gone with the Wind, neither of them make any attempt at doing a dialect, and that's better than if they had attempted it, I think.
No, I agree with you. I think, again, if the dialect's distracting you, it's just not being done well, because they're thinking about it. I promise you they're thinking about it. And in the end, they shouldn't be thinking about it. They should be playing the scene. They should be wanting whatever that character wants at that moment and going about it the way that character would and living that and not thinking, is my accent right?
Well, just at the same time that Saving Mr. Banks came out, Tom Hanks had that other movie, which now I suddenly can't remember the title of, where he's the captain of the ship, the Samoan.
Captain Phillips.
Yes, thank you. And I thought his dialect was a little distracting in that picture.
Well, you know, I didn't work on that. So I think that's not something I really want to comment on.
No comment. All right. She says no comment.
Yeah.
You know, Jessica Drake, I know that you have a background in theater. You come from a theatrical family. Your father was the actor Ken Drake, and your mother, our friend Sylvie Drake, the theater critic. Tell us a little bit about growing up in that family.
Well, let's see.
I remember your dad on Sea Hunt. He was constantly being killed. He was the villain, and he got killed every other week. He was a different villain.
He got killed pretty much every other week. That's right. That was a notoriously low-budget show produced by a guy who produced a lot of low-budget shows. It was a company called Ziv TV. And they did Highway Patrol, which my dad was on as well.
I love that.
A lot of other shows, though. And anyway, he hired my dad to do all those Sea Hunts because my father was also very good at makeup and accents. And so he could be all these different people without them even having to hire a makeup man. So that's
so
how he managed to get killed over and over again. Yes, exactly.
And he did accents, so that was that something that he would do around the house, and you always picked up on that and did accents too?
Well, no, I don't know that he did them around the house, but it was definitely part of it. He taught speech for a while. My father was an Okie from literally born in Enid, Oklahoma, and grew up in Central California, and he wanted to overcome that in a big way. So he was really invested in his speech training and then taught it later on. And then my mother grew up speaking five languages. So her family, who I was very close to, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, they would be speaking simultaneously, really, in five languages at once. If you sat down at the table with them, you were going to hear French, Italian, Arabic, Greek, English, and I was all going to get kicked around. And someone would say something in French and answer it in English, or, you know, some other combination. So even though I didn't speak those languages, which is a tragedy, really, and that was just because I was an obstinate child, they were always trying to make me answer them in French, and I wouldn't do it, even though I understood what they were saying. And they used it a lot to hide things from me, and I would always figure stuff out because I knew what they were saying. But there was something about that mix, that I will say has come in very handy in this career. I don't know whether it's because it's made my ears susceptible or what. And also, it was these things were a value in my family. Some people would probably argue a skewered sort of weird value to have, but I definitely knew that was the world I wanted to be in. And it seemed exciting to me, and nothing else much did. And I was not very good in school, so it's a good thing I ended up somehow in the profession I'm in, and that's kind of a miracle. But anyway.
How did you transition from acting to dialect coach?
Well, you know, it's funny how the twists and turns that happen in a person's life. I ended up at L.A. City College because I was a disaster in high school and didn't take anything you're supposed to take to go to college. So I didn't even have the requirements to go to, you know, a state college. I hadn't taken any of the stuff. I didn't.
Well, those classes are hard and boring.
Yeah, and I, you know, I.
And we had to go to the movies.
Yes. But that was, I can't even begin to tell you. I will say that you and I went to see a lot of old movies together when we were in high school, and that is an education that I treasure to this day. That really gave me an understanding of the history of film that I call upon constantly.
Oh, I'm glad my bad influence was a good influence.
I cannot thank you enough for that. I really can't.
Good.
But anyway, I ended up at LA City College because I, you know, could get in there, and took a lot of theater classes. And as a result of that, learned about these other kind of big deal drama schools in the East, and decided to try to audition for them. And along the way, I kept hearing this name, Edith Skinner, and she was this great speech and dialect teacher. And I just knew I wanted to study with her. I don't know why, really, because I didn't have any intention of being a dialect coach. I wanted to be an actor. But I went off to Carnegie Mellon University for a year thinking that she was still there. She had taught there for decades. Well, I didn't do my homework because that's the kind of thing that I did at that age. I just had no idea that she hadn't been there for 5 years. And she was teaching at Juilliard. And I went off there and she wasn't there. And I didn't like it very much there for various reasons. I wasn't too happy with the program. And I thought... And I wasn't too happy with Pittsburgh either, which is where it is. And by then I had kind of overcome my fear of New York City, which when I first went to New York, I didn't like it very much. But it grew on me, and I really fell in love with it. And I thought, well, I'd like to be there. So I auditioned for Juilliard, and she was teaching there. And that was sort of the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And I loved the work, and I was good at it, and I learned later that she sort of always had a girl usually in her class who sort of excelled at it, that became kind of her pet, and that's what happened. We had a very close relationship. She was an amazing person and extremely supportive and loving toward me, which I got to say, Juilliard was not that kind of an environment in those days. That was not at all how that school operated. Quite the opposite. Go see that movie Whiplash. It made me feel like Juilliard all over again. But anyway, Edith passed away 2 months after I graduated from Juilliard. So I ended up studying with her the last 4 years of her life. And really, kind of as a result of her, I started teaching. On the side, I was terrible at all the things actors do, and I managed to get fired. Back in those days, Columbus Avenue from 62nd to 82nd Street was almost nothing but restaurants, and I managed to get fired from every one of them in one summer. I just sort of worked my way up Columbus Avenue, and it was really, you know, talk about don't let the door hit you on your way out. It was really that. So I stank at all those things. And I had friends who bartended and made a lot of money. And I couldn't do any of it. And I thought, I better do something. And I already had people that were asking me for help. And Holly Hunter was a friend of mine when I was at Carnegie. We were in the same class. And she came to New York. Actually, I was in my last year at Juilliard, and she was there newly graduated and trying to get a job. And no one would hire her because of her Southern accent. And she said to me, why don't you help me with this? You could help me with this. You could do this. And she was my first student. And then, of course, ironically, she and I both got our first union job in the same play at the Berkshire Theater Festival, which is an old New England summer stock company, in a new play there. And she played a real Southern firecracker girl. And she basically never looked back. That kind of started everything for her. And she did a number of plays where she had roles like that. And eventually that got her the movie offers, and the rest is history. So that's kind of how it evolved. And then I did it as a day job on the side. And I would help people and say, don't tell anybody who helped you. Because I wanted to be thought of as an actor. And finally, I reached a point, I had done a lot of regional theater in the East. I was offered a play here in Los Angeles, an equity job, an actual paying job in the theater. That's pretty rare in L.A. And my grandfather wasn't well at the time, and we were very close, and I thought, well, that would be good for me to be out there. And so I came out, and to my total astonishment, that job went on for a year. And
the play ran for a year?
It did.
Yeah. What play was that?
Sister Mary Ignatius Explains It All for You, a Christopher Durang play. He just won the Tony for Best Play this year.
Right.
For Sonia Masha Vanya and Spike. But anyway, I ended up out here again, and I was doing, kind of doing the sort of thing my dad had done, you know, occasionally getting a job in television. But my life was really getting, my job was getting a job. And when I got a job, it was a vacation from my job of getting a job.
Right, and it was only for, every job was only for a few days.
A few days.
Yeah.
It was not like doing a play, where at least you had a run for a while. And I was getting very tired of living the way that I was, and I decided to kind of, and i.e. like a college student, I decided I'm going to come out of the closet about my coaching. And at that point, I was teaching also in drama schools. And quite frankly, I was teaching, I had started the voice and speech program at what is called LOXA, the Los Angeles County High School for the Arts, which had just opened its doors. And trying to teach phonetics and speech to a bunch of, you know, 14 to 17-year-olds was really murder. They just were not that into it.
Yeah.
And I thought, if this is going to be my life, I just don't think I can take it. And at that point, I decided, well, you know, I don't know. This acting thing isn't working out. I'm just going to open myself up to whatever comes along. And almost within a week or so of making that decision, just quietly to myself, an old friend, actually an old family friend, Gordon Hunt, director, whose daughter, Helen Hunt, won the Oscar, he recommended me to somebody who was doing a movie and needed someone to help a Dutch actress sound more American, and that was it. It just started, and it snowballed. And all of a sudden, I was in demand, and that was a whole different thing from sitting around and begging people to hire me to now being wanted. And I loved that, and also, I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed being behind the camera. I enjoyed being part of that team on the other side. So it kind of took on a life of its own, and I never had to really struggle. It all started coming to me. Now, that said, you know, by then I'd been teaching, really I'd been teaching a good 10 years. So I suppose there had been a buildup I just wasn't really aware of, but people started throwing my name around, and the work was coming. And
it's been many years. This is, we're talking with Jessica Drake, and she's dialect coach in the one of the most respected dialect coaches in the industry. And you've been working, you know, pretty steadily since, and you've done some incredible films that everybody loves and would be curious to know what it was like to work on them, like L.A. Confidential. You worked with Russell Crowe on that picture.
Yes, I did.
And nobody knew who Russell Crowe was then.
No, but you know, I had worked with him on a few things before we did that, but nothing where they were willing to have a coach for him on the set, you know, really full time, because he wasn't a star.
Right.
And that was the first one. And, you know, I also coached a little bit Guy Pearce,
right,
who played the other role.
Yes.
And
right
also there. Simon Baker had a small role in L.A. Confidential, and they're all Australian.
Right. You can Simon Baker on he's The Mentalist, and you can hear his Australians seeping through sometimes. Who works with him on his show?
He's worked with a lot of different coaches on that show, including me for a minute, but in like season, I don't know what season they're in.
Season 25. When you're watching the show, if you do you hear that like I do? Do you hear it? Oh, he missed it there.
Well, you know, I try not to listen for those. To be honest, when I am watching anything,
yeah,
I really try to surrender that part of myself so that I can just enjoy it.
What about when you're watching?
I want to be caught up in the movie like anybody else. You know?
I'd like that too, but I still notice those things. What about when you're watching stuff that you worked on? Are you hypercritical or?
Yeah, probably more so with that. That's harder to watch also because it's hard to not remember things like, oh God, you know, that was the day when blah 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 was going on, or it was so cold I thought I was going to die, or you know, whatever. So those, yeah, I think when you're watching your own work you are more aware of it. But again, I've been very lucky because I've worked with so many great talents, and they can transport me out of that, too.
Rachel Griffiths is someone you've worked with quite a bit. You worked with her all on the whole run of Six Feet Under, and then you worked on her next show, too, huh?
Yes, and Brothers and Sisters. Rachel and I have done a lot of things together. I met her on a movie called Blow, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Blow.
Yeah, it was a
cocaine
movie, right?
Yes, and she played... This is, I suppose, echoes of the Manchurian Candidate and Angela Lansbury and Lawrence Harvey in that, if anyone remembers that.
Yeah, sure.
But she played Johnny Depp's mother, and she was, I think...
The same age or younger.
The same age or maybe like a year younger than Johnny when she did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we met there, and then we did 6 Feet and Brothers and Sisters, and I worked with her. She did a show on Broadway called Other Desert Cities, which I worked with her on as well.
And right now you're about to start something big. What are you working on now?
I'm going to be working on season 2 of True Detective, HBO. I'm doing a lot of television shows now. So I've got The Walking Dead. We're in season 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got two British actors on that doing Georgia dialects.
Yeah.
And... a few others that I'm working on. How to Get Away with Murder. We've got an English guy on that.
Yeah.
I've
watched that show, by the way.
Oh, you have?
That one. I watched that. I'll show you tell you the shows I watch. I watch How to Get Away with Murder,
uh-huh,
Sea Hunt, Highway Patrol. Those are the things I watch. It's a fascinating career you have, and I want to thank you for spending some time. I need a dialect coach right now. Spending some time talking to us here on From the Bookshelf. Jessica Drake, good luck with your career, and thanks for visiting.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Jessica Drake, dialect coach extraordinaire. You can find her work lots of places, including the recently released Blu-ray of Saving Mr. Banks. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.